Hello, everybody. This is Ian Williams, the President of the Foreign Press Association, and it gives us a great deal of pleasure to be jointly hosting with the Committee to Protect Journalists, our long-standing colleagues, a briefing on the situation in Nicaragua and the press there. This gets confusing for many of us, especially my generation, who were brought up to think that Ronald Reagan was being beastly to poor Daniel Ortega. Well, he might have been, but things have changed. And Daniel Ortega, who is still the toast of many liberals from the old time, has been busily repressing the press, arresting his opponents, and is generally making life untenable for the opposition in Nicaragua. So we have several Nicaraguan journalists, and we also have Natalie Southwick from, I wasn't sure about the pronunciation there, it's Southwick or Southwick. I'm British, so we do strange things to names like that, who will explain to us what the CPJ's concerns in Nicaragua and what's being done. And then we can discuss with our Nicaraguan colleagues what the position is like for people who want to report in Nicaragua, or on Nicaragua, in fact. So, Natalie, what are the CPJ's concerns, and what action are you taking at the moment?
Thanks so much, Ian, and thank you, first of all, to the other panelists for joining us this morning. I'm really excited to hear from you and to have this conversation, and obviously the Foreign Press Association for helping host this. It's Southwick. It's much easier to say in English than Spanish, I will say that. And I'm the program coordinator covering Latin America and the Caribbean with the Committee to Protect Journalists. So CPJ is based here in New York, but we work all around the world. Nicaragua has become a country of increasing concern for our program over the last couple of years, especially since a wave of protests in 2018. It has been, for much longer than that, a difficult environment for independent journalists, but with kind of the wave of protests in 2018, the ensuing crackdown by the government on especially critical voices and journalists who are covering those demonstrations. And then over the last year leading up to these elections that are now less than 2 weeks away, the government has been putting kind of increasingly restrictive measures in place in a number of different areas, from police surveillance to new legislation that allows authorities to have even greater control over information, over critical voices, and particularly over the ever-shrinking space for the independent press. So we've been documenting press freedom violations in Nicaragua as they come up. This year has been especially busy for us in terms of that, with dozens of journalists that have gone into exile in other countries, journalists that have been summoned to be interrogated as part of these ongoing criminal investigations that have allowed the Ortega government to really sideline any sort of political opposition, several journalists that have been imprisoned, and a number of other kind of ways of control that we're keeping an eye on in the country. I think, you know, Nicaragua doesn't necessarily get the same kind of attention in terms of press freedom concerns as perhaps a country like Mexico, where you have incredibly high rates of deadly violence against journalists. That's not something that we have seen so much in a place like Nicaragua, but there are a number of other mechanisms that authorities are able to use for censorship there. So that's kind of what we're seeing. And we really wanted to have this conversation prior to the electoral process that is taking place. I think calling them elections at this point is a bit generous, but we have a lot of concerns about how journalists are going to be treated, how journalists are going to be able to cover that process, how the Nicaraguan public is going to be able to get information about it, and really what comes next. So thank you again for this invitation, and really excited for this conversation.
One of the issues is to what degree the intimidation is having an effect, because we know from our own part, we've consistently followed the situation in Hong Kong, for example. And for the last year, we found it impossible to get anyone from Hong Kong who is willing and able to take the risk to appear on a press briefing and denounce what's happening. You know, privately they will, but they won't get it in public because there's immediate retaliation by the Chinese authorities. Is that the position in Nicaragua as well? Cindy, do you want to come in on that one?
Yes.
Cindy Regido.
Hi. Thanks, Ian, Natalie. Hi, Yamlek. Thank you for organizing this and for having me. Yes, absolutely. That's why here we are, me and Yamlek, we are both Nicaraguans, but we are in Costa Rica. And we decide to participate in these spaces knowing that our colleagues in Nicaragua can't do it. Or if they do it, they will face the consequences. It's a very, very dire situation that what we're going through in Nicaragua. And one of the things that I can tell you is that at this point, our colleagues are no longer putting their names in their articles. No bylines, because that also poses threat. After dozens of us have been interrogated by the prosecutor's office as a way of intimidating us. And this is just like the last part and the last kind of intimidation. There are other many, many ways of intimidating and censoring and harassing the reporters in Nicaragua.
So let's drill down on that one. Are people using pseudonyms or there's just no bylines in the newspaper?
The byline is by Confidencial, the media outlet that I work for, or by La Prensa, because it's a great risk for them. Not only because, like as Confidencial, as a media outlet, is facing persecution, but also in your neighborhood as a reporter, if you have any Sandinista loyals around you and they know that you're a reporter, they will come to your house and they will vandalize it. They will scream things to you. The police will go to your house as an act of intimidation, like I said. And they also can interrogate you, and they say that this is because they're conducting an investigation on an alleged case of money laundering. But in reality, the interrogations are all about who our sources are, how we work, how we decide how to cover the issues in Nicaragua, if we're being paid by the CIA. These things are happening in Nicaragua at this point, and it's going to be very hard for them to cover the voting process in November 7. But I think that despite of all those risks, we're still going to do it. We're just going to be very cautious about how we're going to do that. I don't think that we're going to be able to be inside of the polling stations, for example. But I know a lot of colleagues who are very, very brave and determined, and that they will be outside seeing how it goes.
Are there any signs of them getting advice on this? Because they seem to be following the copybook from Cuba and to some extent from Venezuela, this mixture of sort of activist intimidation and state intimidation at the same time. Are they getting advice from Havana and from Nicaragua?
Yeah, definitely. I don't know if Yamlek also wants to jump in, but yeah, definitely. I will say that it's the same guideline that they are using, the same measures, so that they can control what's being published about Nicaragua. They are they're not letting international correspondents come into the country. Many reporters have denounced that they have filed all the information, submitted information to the immigration office, and they say, nope, you're not welcome in the country. You can't report from Nicaragua about the election. Our colleagues are also not able to leave the country. Some of them have been detained at the airport. They basically they want to have the entire control of the situation and what's being published about what's going on in the country.
Yamlek, you want to come in on this?
Yeah, even though there's no proof that it is a fact that Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela, and even Russia have agreements, international agreements on a lot of issues, including security. So they are probably giving advice. There's advisors telling them what to do, tell them what to replicate, what measures to replicate and what kind of laws that they can apply to limit freedom of expression. It is the case. The problem is that we cannot prove that because of the short access to information that Nicaraguan journalists have. And as Cindy was saying, there's not even the possibility that foreign journalists can go to Nicaragua. So we can really do anything but keep up front and keep searching what they don't want us to find. Yeah.
Natalie, you wanted to come in on this?
Yes, just to follow up on Yamlek's point, especially about the laws that we're seeing, you know, from our perspective at CPJ, we're able to kind of look at when some of these laws get passed. We can compare them to what we've seen in other countries. And so you have a couple of these laws that were passed in Nicaragua over the last year, where immediately for us, they set off alarm bells. You know, we were raising concerns about this legislation last October before it was passed. There's a cyber crimes law. There's a law about foreign agents. So if you're receiving funding from really any entity outside of Nicaragua, you have to register as a foreign agent. That law is essentially copy-pasted from Russia. It's very similar legislation to what we've seen in Russia. The laws about expression online, really similar to the anti-hate legislation that we saw passed in Venezuela back in 2017. One thing that's different, or that's especially concerning about Nicaragua, is the speed. So, you know, Venezuela passed a couple of these laws that essentially allowed criminalization of expression online under this very broad definition of what hate speech is. And it took about 2 years or so for them to really start using it against journalists or even kind of Twitter users. It sort of sat for a while. And so with Nicaragua, when we saw these laws get passed last year, there was a question of, you know, okay, is this laying the groundwork in a similar way? How long is it going to take for these to start being used against people? Unfortunately, the answer has been really quickly. And that's also why it's so important to kind of keep an eye on legislation, even around the region, because we see this happen in different countries where you have someone like Ortega that will see a law like this used successfully to kind of increase censorship and limit expression in another country and will adopt that legislation and then use it within another country. So this is, you know, unfortunately, it's nothing new in kind of the grand scheme of things. It is new in the legal framework in Nicaragua, but we are seeing, you know, the Ortega government kind of pick and choose these pieces of legislation from other countries that they think will be helpful. And it's no surprise that they're drawing from places like Russia and Venezuela.
Well, it also reminds me, Slobodan Milosevic was no slouch at inhibiting the freedom of the press, but he was quite sophisticated. He allowed free print media, and he was asked why. And he said, well, your Serbs watch television and listen to radio. They don't read newspapers. I don't care what's said in the newspapers. How important is the press in Nicaragua internally, and how does it fit in? Does the government have control of the radio and television as well?
Unfortunately, yes. I started my career in 2007. That's right around when Ortega returned to power. And since then, journalists, independent journalists, are not able to attend to official press conferences. We have no access to public information, public data. Even if I wanted to call like the weather institution, and I called and they knew who I was, and they would hang up. Like, no information for not even about the weather, seriously. So it was a hostile relationship with the press. And what the first lady back then, now Vice President Rosario Murillo, said was that the official policy on communication would be, we're not going to let these people contaminate the information. We're going to deliver it ourselves. And well, she took it very personally, like, because she is the one that actually delivers all the information every day through a phone call. She calls to one of her media outlets and she says, she talks about the weather, about the schools, about health issues, about even hate speech against the opposition and journalists. And so what they did is that they decided to establish this policy and also buy the majority of the TV stations and radio stations in the country, where you only see propaganda or entertainment. And there were a few other TV stations that remained, but they were being punished with no access to public advertising funding. And also the government and the channels, the TV stations that they own, they started lowering the prices of advertising so that they would put in place a very an imbalanced competition. And these TV stations progressively decided to just like sell. The TV station that I used to work for sold the TV station to one of Ortega's allies. And so now it is also airing only propaganda and entertainment. And so that's what happened. Like it was like progressively deteriorating. And now people are mostly getting propaganda, entertainment, soap operas, TV series, sports. And the independent media, well, we struggle, but we fortunately have a broad, solid audience who is always looking for what we publish through our media outlets that are mainly now digital, like YouTube, websites, social media. Unfortunately, we have two shows in Confidencial and they were aired on national TV, but since 2018, we are censored. So what we do is that we continue to produce those shows and we put them on YouTube where people can still access. But we have to say that in Nicaragua, the access to internet is still a very low coverage, or people don't have access like on a regular basis to the internet. So that's, we have to admit that that is a problem because people don't have the opportunity to choose what they want to read and see.
Is there a way around this? Is cell phone use prevalent? Can you tailor your electronic media, please?
I'm going to add something, if anything. I think we have to consider that Nicaragua is the second poorest country in Latin America. I come from a low-income neighborhood, and I was the only one in the whole neighborhood, like in the whole 5 blocks in my neighborhood that had internet access at home. The rest of my classmates and my neighbor, they went to parks that had internet, but that are controlled, are government controlled. So yeah, that's a thing. So people has nothing to get informed, and people need like there's radio, but really old people hear to radio. Not everyone is like listening to radio, and there's internet, and there were the newspapers, but that's no longer available, right? So there's very few options for Nicaraguan people to know what is happening in Nicaragua if you are poor, and a lot of people are poor in Nicaragua. I don't think my family, for example, could be very well informed if I wasn't telling them what is happening in Nicaragua, or my friends, because Nicaragua is trying to disinform people, is trying to mislead them to think that they're the good guys and that nothing is happening and that no one was killed in Nicaragua. And if they were killed, they were doing something bad. But that's really not the case. But they are doing all their efforts to limit the access of information for people and low-income people to think that. So that's the strategy, really. They don't want us to know what is happening because it's not convenient for them.
So in a sense, it's economic censorship. It's not like Cuba, where the internet is under direct government control, and or China. I mean, since they're taking advice from Venezuela and Cuba, then we can presume that they will also be calling on the comrades in Beijing to say, how do you run the great Chinese wall on the internet? There's not any sign of that technology being used?
I think one of the better examples for that is Cuba. In Cuba, the internet is controlled by the government. It's not the case for Nicaragua. People with internet at home can access to sites like Confidencial or La Prensa, but that's not the case for public internet, for example. The sites are blocked. Some sites that can be used for information are blocked too. People only have social media, but we know that social media is a problem, since you don't control what kind of disinformation can be or not. Maybe there's tweets and things that can inform people, but you can't control that. And they know that. So that's why they do the laws on ciberdelitos, because they can't control it, but they can process legally people that says things contrary to the government. That had happened. Nicaragua, I remember, maybe I'm mistaken, but they got in jail a guy that made TikToks against the government, because TikTok is a platform that can express and spread a lot of information very quickly. So he was in trouble because of that. So that's what, that also happens in places like Venezuela or Cuba or Russia or China. So they are taking notes from them, but they are doing also their own thing. And that own thing, it's even more evil sometimes.
You know, the Ortega and his spouse are in an anomalous position in some ways. For example, Nicaragua has one of the most repressive laws on abortion in the continent, if not the world, I understand, which is one of the first signs that this was not the Daniel Ortega who Ronald Reagan opposed originally. So how was the US government's approach to this? Was Donald Trump for or against Ortega? Did he care?
He was completely against, and he had a very good rhetoric, I would say, about how we're going to do something about Nicaragua because this is communism taking over the hemisphere or whatever. And the administration, the Trump administration, put in place some measures, but so did the Congress. Some sanctions have been applied to government officials based on corruption acts and human rights abuses. But I don't think that has been enough. And now we have the Biden administration that is also saying, yes, we have a problem in Nicaragua. This is an authoritarian regime. But I don't think that this is like a subject that they wanna actually address directly. I don't know why, but I feel like they're focusing on the Northern Triangle with the whole migration crisis. But Nicaragua is not part of that plan, even though they're talking about how important it is to have democracy and human rights in place so that people don't leave their countries. And so I don't know what's going on exactly, and I don't want to speculate, but it's very interesting that the Biden administration is not following up, because in Nicaragua, we already have thousands of people fleeing from the country, not only to Costa Rica, which is the main destination and has been the main destination for years and decades, but also to the United States. Before the crisis, you only had like 1,000 Nicaraguans that were apprehended in the borders in the United States. At this point, at the end of 2021 fiscal year, we have 50,000 Nicaraguans that were apprehended in the U.S. borders. So I think it should be a matter of great concern for the Biden administration. And I also would like to say that this is so very different from what happened in the 80s with the Reagan administration and the Cold War era. Completely different, Ian.
I know, but not everybody catches up on this. There's yeah. a lot of people in America who think that Putin is the last defender of socialism in the world. Right. imperialism. Right. It's yeah. the same in Nicaragua, that they support Chavez and they support they'll support Ortega because Reagan opposed them. And no one seems to have noticed that things have changed. The abortion law in Nicaragua, which was a real turning point for many people to show that this was not your cozy Sandinistas, I don't think it was noticed enough by many people.
That is right. Yes. No, Ortega claims that he's a socialist, that he's left wing, that he's progressive, but he is not at all. And you can see that very easily, starting with the abortion ban in 2007, when he was a candidate in 2006. He desperately needed to have a reconciliation with the Catholic Church, which plays a huge role in Nicaraguan society. And the Catholic Church wanted to ban abortion completely. We had a law in place that allowed women to have abortion in case their health and their lives were at risk. And so what Ortega did is that he promised the Catholic Church that if he won, he would ban that law. And so he did. And the Catholic Church had a better relationship with him for a long time, not anymore. And so this is one of the examples on how Ortega is not a left-wing politician. I think that he presents himself that way because that's what's valuable to him, especially in the international political arena, because he can present himself as a victim of imperialism. But in fact, the only thing he cares about is power and money.
Yes. Do we foresee a state visit to Texas, to Florida at some point, since he's so like-minded with the governors there?
I think one of the things, just to this point about, you know, these kind of shifting priorities and shifting kind of identities that has been, you know, is something that comes up for those of us that work in and cover Latin America, especially over the last 10 years, is you kind of had this, the so-called pink tide, the era of these leftist leaders throughout the region about 10 plus years ago. And it is true that a lot of the coverage, certainly in the US and in other parts of the world, is really kind of through this lens of conflicts of 20 plus years ago. And those are relevant, but the leaders have shifted, the personalities have shifted. Even in cases like Nicaragua, where you have the same people in power, they're adopting new tactics. They are operating in a completely different environment. And I think it has, in some senses, made it hard for people to keep up. At the same time, we have these kind of new threats that just absolutely didn't exist 10 years ago. You know, Yamlek is talking about Ortega implementing this cyber crimes legislation precisely because their strategy of media control that has been in place since, you know, they returned to power in 2007, of having family members take over ownership of media outlets that worked for television, it worked for radio. It doesn't work for social media. It doesn't work for digital outlets in the same way. And so you have to come up with a new tactic. We're seeing that with governments that are using spyware against journalists. You know, there are all these tools that simply can't necessarily be applied to old frameworks. And so I think that's part of why these conversations are important for us to understand, you know, what some of the risks are, like, you know, same as the old boss, but a lot of them are new, and it's important for us to see what they are.
If you analyze any law that Daniel Ortega has put on these 15 years of government, you immediately know that he's not a leftist. You know that he is a right-wing leader and is with this umbrella of leftism because that's convenience for him. And you said it yourself with the abortion ban. Nicaragua had free abortion rights since 1890, since the 1890s. And in 2006, when Ortega needed something, he did what he had to do, and he really didn't care what he thought about the abortion. He just knew that he needed to say something against it so he could win voters. And if you analyze Rosario Murillo, for example, she was a Buddhist before 2006, and all of a sudden she was a Catholic. So you know what their personalities are. They are like chameleons.
They even got married in church, Daniela, yeah. Rosario Murillo, in 2006, yeah. Prior to the election.
Because in they needed it. Yeah.
Not a Buddhist temple.
They're like chameleons. I see them like that. They change as they need to change, and they say what they need to say so they can stay more in power. And I'm kind of disagreeing on he's not the same person he was 30 years ago. I think he is. He's just showing his true colors now. I think he lost power ever since, and that he did what he had to do back then so we all can like him, since for international left to like him. But he doesn't need international left anymore because the left has changed. So he now is showing what he thinks and their true colors and what he needs to do. So, yeah.
But internationally, he does seem to be aligning with Maduro in Nicaragua and with the Cuban regime as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think they're stepping their ground. Like, we are not going to be against them, but we're also not going to be to agree with them. We see that, for example, in the United Nations Chamber, for example, Argentina or Mexico saying we are not going to vote for them, but not going to vote against them. But I think the left know that what is happening in Nicaragua, Cuba, and Venezuela is as wrong as what's happening in other countries with right authorities. But they don't want to admit it because they're still in love with the idea that is leftism. And it's very sad because what is happening in Nicaragua is not a thing of beliefs. It's not a thing of credos. I don't remember the word in English, but it's not a belief thing. It's not a left or right thing. It's a human right thing. So, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of people are prepared to overlook defaults in human rights if it's in the right cause or in the left cause, I find. We saw it all over. So are there any questions from the end? You can put them in the Q&A or the chat if you want on the floor. We've had a few in so far. But so Simon Locke was going down on the question. I think we answered it earlier. Are conversations taking place between Russia, Venezuela, and Nicaragua on the implementation of these laws? Sorry. Yes? Do you know, are there any direct signs of conversations to get Nicaraguan advisors in the in Managua?
Is that a question for me?
Anybody, that? Anybody.
I mean, I can certainly say, you know, again, to the point earlier, it's not always necessary even to have kind of direct, like, again, we're seeing places like Nicaragua see laws that are implemented in other countries and emulate them. And that is a pattern that comes up fairly regularly, especially in Latin America, I think, because, you know, partly because you can literally take the language of one law and just kind of tailor it to your needs. So we see that with some defamation legislation. We see that with, you know, some of the cyber crimes laws that echo the language that we see in other countries. And so it's not even a case of necessarily, well, is there kind of, you know, direct advice, but if you are someone like Ortega Murillo and you want to look at the law that's being implemented in Russia and you say, oh, well, this seems to be working really well in terms of restricting independent and critical reporting in Russia, maybe there's something to take from this. And again, this is part of kind of a broader media strategy. I think, you know, we see leaders throughout the region kind of regardless of where they are on the political spectrum, kind of pulling tactics from each other, whether it was, you know, a couple years ago, a number of different presidents adopting the fake news rhetoric. You saw that. That started with Chavez back, you know, 12 plus years ago. He was one of the early adopters of fake news. Right. And then you saw Duterte in the Philippines and Erdogan in Turkey and Bukele in El Salvador and Bolsonaro in Brazil. It was for whoever it was politically expedient for them to kind of make the press an enemy. And so you do have these regional and even kind of global trends where leaders with authoritarian tendencies will pick and choose these tactics that they think are going to be helpful for them as they try to control the press. And certainly we're seeing that in Nicaragua, especially this year with, you know, the very real concern that this government seems to have about people possibly running against them in the elections, and the really extreme measures that they've taken to sideline political opponents and in particular to really limit the space for critical reporting.
Apart from the media, what effect does this have on the normal population? I mean, Michael McDonald wants you to answer. I'm wondering what the sense is on the ground in Nicaragua. How afraid are people to speak, and how hard is it to get sources to speak to you? I mean, I found this in authoritarian countries that, you know, you've had to go sneaking around back walls and, you know, talking anonymously to people where no cameras are present to get any sense. And even then you have to promise not to use their names. Is that the sense of what's happening in Nicaragua?
It is definitely the case. It is so hard for us lately because, well, first of all, since 2018, there is a state police where people cannot go to any kind of demonstration unless you're a Frente Sandinista loyal. In that case, you can go to the streets and show your support to the regime. But if you're not, and if you want to carry a national flag, the Nicaraguan flag, that can't mean that you are against the government, because that was like the main symbol during the protest in 2018. And that can present a problem if the police asks you why you're carrying that flag with you. And so I think there is a lot of fear in people because they have also seen how other people have ended up in jail for talking to the press, especially during the last months. A lot of our sources, human rights defenders, civic leaders, the presidential hopefuls, they were all giving interviews about what their thoughts were on the election, and they are now all in jail. I want to mention this case that was very hard for me to process because I know it wasn't my fault, but I felt really bad about this interview that I carried for our show with a human rights defender. And she was explaining why all these accusations, the judicial accusations against the opposition members were not consistent, were not legally binding. And 1 week after that interview, she was in jail. She's been in jail for over 90 days now. And what the government is saying is that she was inciting fear or inciting treason or foreign intervention. And so it's a very, very unbelievable situation. And so what people do, regular people do in Nicaragua, is that they avoid any kind of political topic. They avoid making any kind of comment about the government. And even talking about the pandemic can pose a threat if you are defying the official discourse that says that very, very few people have died in Nicaragua, which is a lie. And people know that because they have family and friends who have died from coronavirus. But even like defying that discourse can pose a threat, even in like doctors who are speaking about how people should protect themselves. And they're saying, don't go out, but the government wants you to go out and they're inviting you to go to different activities in the country. And the doctors who are saying, please don't do that, they are also being questioned by the authorities.
So they're using the power of the state on the vaxxer, anti-vaxxer issue as well. Are there any vaccinations, in fact?
To follow on Cindy's point, just to really emphasize that, I mean, that's something that we heard from journalists on the ground beginning last year, you know, when COVID arrived in Nicaragua, because it did get to Nicaragua, despite what government authorities said. There was a period of several months where there was just absolute denial. And we heard from journalists there that even trying to cover the existence of the pandemic in the country was putting them at risk. That by doing reporting on what they saw happening around them in their neighborhoods and in the hospitals, they were contradicting the official statistics. And the same way that doctors who were speaking to the media were then threatened or punished for sharing what they were also seeing in their work, the journalists who were trying to keep their fellow citizens informed, who were trying to keep people safe, who were trying to give people information so they could protect themselves, were then being threatened and punished. And so I think that that's a really good example of the way that, you know, trying to get at the truth and trying to tell, trying to convey news stories about what's actually happening when it contradicts the official line can be really dangerous, even when it is just doing your job. The pandemic is just the latest example of that.
Just an example on coronavirus, people that is hospitalized have no right to bring their cell phones to where they are in the hospital because they don't want people recording what is happening in there. I know this firsthand. Some of my close circle told me because they were hospitalized, and they take the phones away so they cannot record, they cannot talk to people, and if they do, it's in a very sneaky way where nurses give them like 2 minutes so they can talk to their loved ones since they are sick and they can die. But there's no way on talking to them because the government rathers their confidentiality than human rights and being allowed to speak to their loved ones when they are about to die. So that's Gypsy, just an example.
Gypsy Gian Kaiser was wanted to know which topics are taboo for coverage in Nicaragua at the moment. Specifically, is coverage of abortion censored? Well, we've obviously got it. Coverage of COVID is censored. Are there any other subjects that are off the record as far as the government's concerned?
Everyone, like everything is off the topics for them if they were up to them. Really?
And I think that they're also very sensitive about, there is also a law, the cyber law also includes punishment for those who leak public information. I think that's a very sensitive topic because this is a very corrupt regime as well. And so somebody asked about the informants. Yes, we have lots of sources and we value them greatly because that's how we are able to do what we do, thanks to what the information that they provide. And so when we have informants or people from inside the public institutions, and we can finally access to contracts or any kind of information that we have never seen, and we find that there is corruption or irregularities, I think that the government despises all those things, and they're very scared that these things see the light of the day, because it means that they can either lose part of their political base or they're being portrayed as for who they are, which is corrupt. And so I think that that's also very sensitive, any kind of public information that has been hidden since they came to power. But yeah, we greatly appreciate the help of these informants and the information and the documents that they have provided to us and that we use for our investigative reports.
Rupert Shaw asked, is there a culture of informants? And I think you partly alluded to that. But I suspect what Rupert's talking about is a culture of spies, of neighborhood informants, informing on people.
Just to add something, I think I work in a Costa Rican news outlet, and the norm in there is to publish names. And if you don't publish the name, it's actually low quality publication, since there is no names to say in the paper, right? But that's not a thing in Nicaragua, since everyone is taking care of their backs, and journalists and news outlets are like lepers. So if we want information to be published about what is happening in Nicaragua, there's like a 90% probability that we cannot publish what source gave us that information. And yeah, there are people like spies inside, well, not spies, but people that know that what's happening in Nicaragua is bad, and they want to give a little bit of help to news media. So yeah, but there's people that need to not to be mentioned. Like, we cannot, people cannot know that we even know each other. So there's like that level of secrecy in Nicaragua. Like, people inside of official work in Nicaragua, like government work, that give information to the media, but are not allowed, journalists are not allowed even to address them directly, not even to speak to them.
Okay, Cindy, you want to come back on the
I apologize. Do you mean informants, like from the government doing like intelligence?
Informants to the, yes, from the government. I mean, you know, in Cuba, they have people in every barrio who are, you know,
absolutely
agents for the revolution.
Yes, yes. From top to bottom, they have created this system where you have Sandinista loyals who are affiliated to this thing called CPC, which is Comité de Poder Ciudadano, like Power Citizenship Committee. And that's basically what they do. They have to, like, the leaders, the community leaders, they have to have all the information, gather information about the political preferences of their neighbors, who they follow, what they do, if they're against the government. They oftentimes go and do some polling regarding the government. What do you think of the government? Are you going to vote for the government, for Daniel Ortega on November 7th? Will you go to vote on November 7th? Yeah, definitely. And inside the public institutions, they have also very militant Frente Sandinista loyals who are also doing that kind of work, you know, like making sure that all the state workers are in line, that they are not leaking any kind of information. Definitely, this is how they work, and they're very efficient in that.
I'm trying to draw some small comfort here, is that I haven't heard, but please correct me if I'm wrong. Yes, people are being imprisoned and they're being harassed legally, but are there death squads stalking the streets? Are people being beaten up and physically manhandled?
They are not, if they're not messing with politic issues, you know? Like, if you don't do anything about, if you're not considered a terrorist, then you can go about and do whatever you have to do. There's a lot of corruption, though. If you are close to, you have ties with the Sandinista loyals, then you will get like special treatment. But other than that, no, like there is not, if you are not involved in any kind of political situation, then you can like go on and have like a sort of regular life.
But it's marginally safer to be a journalist in Nicaragua than Mexico, for example, even though the government's not behind it. Is that right?
No, I don't think so. There's a lot of colleagues of us that had to leave the country because it is not secure to be a journalist in Nicaragua, especially because Mexico and other countries are way bigger countries with way bigger population. But if you're a journalist in Nicaragua and if you work in news, people know you. People know who you are because we are just 6 million people, and it's like a farm in Nicaragua. People know you. And if the government doesn't do something to you directly, people in your community on favor of the government will do something to you. That actually happened to me. So it is not secure. And if you have to stay in the country, if you can't leave, you have to be hiding in constant hiding, because even if the police doesn't do something to you, a crazy person that is on favor of the regime will do something to you, and that I can assure you.
Well, I think this is a really important kind of question that comes up, certainly as we think about the work that we do. It's a question that we get a lot, right? That's like, is this country more dangerous than this country? Which is the worst country to be a journalist? And there's not a right answer to that. There are challenges and there are dangers in pretty much every country. Certainly in the region, it's probably you're certainly better off being a journalist in Uruguay than a lot of other countries in Latin America, but it's hard to kind of do a direct comparison of those risks, right? Where we do have, again, very high rates of deadly violence against reporters in Mexico, in Brazil, in Honduras, where the risks that you're running have to do with organized crime and reporting on sensitive issues, which has some parallels to Nicaragua. But then in countries where there is really sort of widespread and diffuse state control over information and over not just information, but all areas of the government, over many sort of parts of daily life, authorities don't need to resort to deadly violence to control and to censor the media. That's why you don't see journalists getting killed in Cuba. You know, Cuba is not a deadly country to be a journalist, but it is one of the hardest countries in the hemisphere to be a journalist because information is so controlled. And so I think there's sort of a tendency to not even like undersell, but it's hard to compare these two things when you have really intense state control that doesn't necessitate deadly violence against journalists as a way of intimidating them. Versus a place where you have a lack of state presence and you have other armed groups that are operating in that space. And so the way that they choose to control information in the media is through those means. But it's not a race to the bottom. It is challenging and dangerous for journalists in many countries.
And we've had the question, we know that the political candidates, the opposition, are being locked up because it takes them out of the way. Any statistics on how many actual reporters or writers are locked up?
It depends who you ask. Everyone has different statistics. Currently, CPJ has two cases of journalists or media workers that are jailed, we believe, because of the actual work that they've been doing. That's Miguel Mendoza, who is a sports reporter who has been in prison since June, and Juan Lorenzo Holman, who is the general manager of La Prensa, the newspaper, who has been imprisoned since August. There's also Miguel Mora, who ran a news outlet for a number of years, actually received a Press Freedom Award from CPJ several years back, but we don't consider him in our statistics of journalists who are imprisoned for their work right now because he had actually stepped down from the outlet and was getting into politics. So there's kind of a porous border for a couple people that have been involved in media and also in the political realm. But there are certainly a number of individuals who are viewed as some type of political opposition, whether that has to do with working for a human rights organization, actually declaring a political candidacy, or in the case of some of the people on our list, just engaging in some critical reporting.
And Natalie, do you have a question for the other panelists?
I do, although if they want to respond to that previous question before.
I would just like to add about the case of Miguel Mendoza. I don't know if you mentioned it, the sports journalist, who is more of a blogger. So he was put in jail for expressing his opinion on political issues. And there
he
could
didn't support
be more.
Rosario's team.
Yeah, definitely not on her team. And there could be more. Like my boss, our director, he had to flee the country twice recently he had to do it again because his house was raided and he's falsely accused of money laundering. And I think that the plan was to put him in jail as well. And I think that the fact that they have been calling dozens of journalists as supposedly witnesses to this case of money laundering is also a warning for them, saying we could put you in jail if we want to. You know, it's a very, very dire situation. And so that's why we have over 30 journalists who have fled the country again this year.
Yeah, I think that's a really key point, right? Is that for a lot of people, they preemptively chose to remove themselves from the sort of direct line of fire and
but you,
didn't want to wait.
You mentioned earlier that sometimes they were refused exit at the airport.
Yeah,
there have been some cases of that. I would love to hear from the two other panelists. We've talked a lot about the challenges and the many, many dangers for journalists. But one thing that I've been really struck by in my conversations with Nicaraguan reporters over the last, 4 years, really, is how even people that have left the country, like both of you, that there was, 2018 seemed like it was kind of an inflection point for a lot of people, especially the younger generation of reporters, for whom this was a really kind of career defining moment of people doing reporting that they'd never done before. I've heard from people that all of a sudden they felt like they were, really applying the skills that they had learned and that they were in the middle of something very important. And we've seen since then, even people that have relocated to Costa Rica or to other places are creating small projects that allow them to continue reporting on what's happening in Nicaragua. And there's this really deep commitment to continuing to tell the stories of what's happening in Nicaragua, even from beyond the borders. And so I just love to hear kind of your perspective on that and looking ahead a little bit so that it's not, entirely about
doom and gloom.
Right. I think it's important to really emphasize the amazing work that so many Nicaraguan journalists are continuing to do.
Yeah, I can say some things around that. Well, when people when journalists started leaving the country in 2018, and I'm talking from my experience, we didn't know what we had in front of us. We didn't know Costa Rica. We didn't have contacts in Costa Rica. We didn't have a network of support in the countries that we that we leave now. So I myself started reporting on immigration and the after of the flee and the after of we left the country now what. So that was and is my main topic right now. But I know some colleagues that were from TV and that they didn't necessarily talk about politics before in their jobs that felt the need, one, to keep reporting on Nicaragua, because that's the only way. That's the logic that I left Nicaragua, but Nicaragua hasn't left from me. So I know some colleagues that started projects and because they needed to do something. Many colleagues that I know are not working in journalism. They are now working as waiters, as other technical jobs, because it's not like Costa Rica or Spain receive you with open arms with a journalist job. And because the journalist jobs here are kind of different since the culture in general is different. So they do what they have to do to eat, but they don't leave Nicaragua. They are still working on stories in their free time to keep informing people, because that's the only way. I don't see any other form to keep leaving myself in peace than knowing that I'm at least helping a little bit. And I know that's the case of most people and most journalists that left the country in Nicaragua, mainly since 2018, I guess. So yeah, we do what we have to do to eat. If I have to clean rooms, I'll do it, but I'm going to still talking about Nicaragua because it's what I love. I love my country. I don't love the state that is in, but I love my country. And if I have to do something to help, I will do it. And the only way that I can help, because that's the only title that I have, I'm not a political person, but the only title that I have is just a journalist, I will do that, maybe trying to help someone or something.
Thank you, Emily. I think that's a resounding note to finish on because we're coming towards the end of the time. And thank you, Natalie and Cindy, for the contributions. And just, I was hoping for confirmation, but next week we are planning to have Holly McKay, who is reporting from Kabul, a single American woman reporter. Well, Australia, as a matter of fact. And it's interesting, it just occurred to me, our problem is getting an internet connection fixed up for a time with the time difference, but she is more free to report from the so-called ferocious Taliban-controlled Afghanistan than our colleagues here are from their own home country. That's a fairly sobering thought. We will let you know when Holly does come, but you know, obviously she's got her problems, but they're not the same problems as the Nicaraguan journalists are facing. And we really need to scotch the rumor that in any way Ortega is a progressive anti-imperialist defender of human rights. If he ever was, that would appear that it's buried in the Sandinista grave somewhere. But thank you very much, everybody. Look forward to seeing you all soon. Do follow the Foreign Press Association. Do follow and support the Committee to Protect Journalists and the work that they're doing, revealing what it costs. And by the way, we have also had a joint campaign about American requirements of foreign journalists to register as foreign agents as well. So, you know, we are equal opportunities campaigners on these matters. Thank you very much. Thank you, Natalie. Thank you, the CPJ. Thank you, the panelists. See you again soon, I hope.
Thank you.
Heroes. Thank you both so much for joining. It was really fantastic.
Okay, we've got your global impunity index up. Good. Thanks, Natalie. It was good. They were good, and it's always difficult. Thanks, Cindy.
Thank you.
Of course, it would have made for more dramatic effect if we managed to interview you from your prison cell in Managua, but I'm glad we didn't have to.
Preferable to not have to do that for a week. I'm just going to say, like, from my perspective, and I think the perspective of everyone who's worried about their colleagues in Nicaragua, we really would prefer to not have any more cases of imprisoned journalists.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah.
No voluntary martyrs.
But thank you both so much. I truly appreciate you making the time and being part of this conversation. I think it's really important for folks to hear what it's like continuing to report on Nicaragua.
No, thank you both so much. These spaces are very valuable to us. And sometimes we feel that, well, we're everywhere. There are things happening, and sometimes like even worse things, but we don't want to feel alone. We want to feel that there are people out there paying attention and worrying about our situation and trying to make it better for us.
Okay, well, anything we can do to help, but there didn't seem to be much at the moment.
It helps a lot, really. One of the most important things to do for Nicaragua is to keep speaking on it.